Hello and welcome to History Now. On today's show, we've got a very interesting topic. We're going to discuss the role of the Catholic Church in the Troubles. And joining me today is Dr. Maggie Scull, who'll be talking about her book, The Catholic Church and the Northern Ireland Troubles, 1968 to 1998. Maggie, welcome to the show. Just to begin with, it's something I ask anybody who has a book, because it's intriguing to me. How did you come about to choose this topic of the Catholic Church and the Troubles?
So that's a really interesting question. When you come to the conflict as an outsider, you hear so much about Protestants versus Catholics. And then when you start to do a lot more research yourself, you realize religion is not one of the main drivers of this conflict. But as I kept reading and researching, I was thinking, why don't we talk about religion or religious institutions in a lot of the main scholarship? There are, of course, some incredible scholars like John Buer and Gladys Ganell, Maria Power, Marianne Elliott, just to name a few, that are really the pioneers of looking at religion and religious institutions in the conflict, but they're only sort of a small step in this field. So I thought, why don't I just look at one religious institution and look at its impact on the conflict? I think I'm trying to reassert that narrative of what did one religious institution, what role did it play? How did it both mediate and agitate that conflict?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a resurgence in historiography on elements of Irish history from the perspective of religious institutions now. I think there's something of a trend there happening, but it is a very interesting viewpoint of this. At the beginning of your book, you mentioned like outside influences on the Catholic Church, things like liberation theology. What impact did that have on the thinking of people within the Catholic Church around the 1960s?
I think that's a really interesting position that the Irish Catholic Church really holds itself in the 1960s. It's still probably has the highest mass attendance rates in all of Europe at that time, the weekly mass attendance rate. It's still one of the largest exporter of missionaries, including religious women and Irish priests. So at that point during our history of Ireland, if you were a Catholic family, it was still very much prestigious to have a child go into the Catholic Church, go into religious orders. So in every sort of family that I talked to, every sort of priest and religious sister I talked to, there was some sort of other missionary priest or religious sister as part of that family. And so they were getting sort of this transference of ideas from these other places. Liberation theology was sort of trickling into Ireland, still very much a conservative Catholic Church at this period. So we start to see little bits and pieces of liberation theology. However, it's still very much the bastion of only a handful of priests that I talk about in the book. The other influences I'd really say are still the same that happen for everybody here in the North. It's the idea of televisions, more televisions in people's homes in Ireland throughout the early and late 1960s. So people are seeing like the African-American civil rights movement are being inspired by that at the same time. It's not just individuals, but religious women and priests are also seeing that as a sort of inspiration when we think about the conflict here.
Yeah, and so when we move into the point at the first chapter of your book, the civil rights movement, what was the role of the Catholic Church in the civil rights movement? Because for me, it seems a bit ambiguous at the beginning.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, and when I'm using that term, I'm thinking bishops, archbishops, Irish cardinals, they're the ones that have other things really on their minds when the civil rights movement comes out. I talk about this in the book. They're thinking about Mater Hospital. They're thinking about a second university, possibly for Derry at some point. They're thinking about Humanae Vitae that had just come out that same year in 1968. So they're not really at the front and center of the civil rights movement. On the other hand, you do have priests and religious women that are going to the civil rights marches that are being involved. So it's a bit of a split dichotomy here. It doesn't really happen until really the 5th of October, 1968 civil rights march that the Catholic Church kind of the hierarchy wakes up to what's happening here. And even then, it seems to be mostly in statements rather than in action from them.
Right. And it's interesting you're talking about, you know, splits between hierarchy and the priests on the ground. There seems to be a split among the, you know, the congregation, for want of a better term. Younger people seem, I don't know how widespread this was, but you've mentioned that some were showing signs of anti-clericalism. How does that go down?
So that's a really interesting point, especially in the civil rights movement, when sometimes the marches will turn into riots and there'll be a lot of young men and young women in attendance as well. I think some of this anti-clericalism, as I talk about in the book, stems from sort of a push against authority figures. And you have to remember at this time, the average age for a parish priest is somewhere in their 50s. So it's someone that they're not really looking to as a comrade or looking to as someone that of their own age. They're looking to it as an authority figure. So there's definitely a push against that. But at the same time, Republicans will go on to very much use the Catholic Church and use individual priests and religious sisters as people to mediate between themselves and to mediate between the British government throughout the conflict. Catholic priests during this period are sort of at the forefront of trying to protect their communities as well. They're the ones being the go-between for when the British army arrives and their community between the RUC. They seem to be the people that you can go to for information. And in this period of the late 1960s and early 70s, there are a lot more sort of priests on the ground. Their numbers are still quite high. So they're able to operate in small groups to get that information for the community.
Right. Just on the back of that, mm-hmm. we said there's a lot of priests on the ground. They're mediators and go-betweens. Does that change rapidly, or does it change over time, the role that they have and the numbers that are involved in that type of thing?
Absolutely. I think we can talk about issues like internment without trial and the introduction of internment without trial. Priests are really at some of the forefront of campaigning against this. About 71 priests, as I have in my book noted, decided to boycott that census that year in a way to boycott against internment without trial. That's about 11% of the priesthood in Northern Ireland, so not an insignificant number. Also, more than 300, almost 400 priests sign a statement condemning internment without trial, and they send this to the British government. You have people like Father Dennis Fall that are very much rallying against this policy, and people like Monsignor Raymond Murray as well. But that does change over time, and I do think it's with the end of the 1972 IRA ceasefire that happens, that we see sort of a backing off of both a lot of priests and the hierarchy itself, a change in the tone of the majority of the Catholic Church towards the conflict. It's not going to be something that they can just fix right away. It's something that they're going to need to look at in a more long-term thing, and it's going to be much more complex and complicated with the end of that ceasefire.
Yeah. So can we talk about that, the boycott of the census?
Yes.
Where did that come from, that, you know, decision to boycott the census? It's a widespread
yes.
thing, but where did the decision for the priests to boycott, how did that come about?
So it came from a lot of individual priest groups that would have thought of this idea. And it's not just the priest that did it. I believe Jerry Fitt also tried to boycott the census that year, and another of school teachers, about 30 of them, did as well. So it wasn't just that the priest created this idea. It was a form of protest that other people were using. The thing I like to think about of these priests in this era is that it's not just one sort of leader of it all. Father Dennis Fall was very instrumental of gathering those signatures for the boy to sign, effectively saying they're against internment. But it was not just one person saying we're all going to boycott at the same time. It kind of happens organically, and then the priests get together to do it in each community.
So another thing you've mentioned there is the 1972 ceasefire. Mm. Can you give us any indication of what the Catholic Church's role was in and around that period?
So from what I have discovered in the book, there were a number of priests that would have been a go-between between the Republican groups at that time. But the Catholic Church itself was sort of waiting with bated breath, but still the entire time the hierarchy has been condemning violence. I think that's a crucial point to make, is that from day one, the hierarchy unequivocally condemned violence. It's often where we don't see it is who reports on those condemnations. Something that I tried to bring out a lot in the book. So what we have when we think about the 72 ceasefire is sometimes a newspaper source, especially from the British media, will only be picking up maybe a sentence or two from a statement a bishop or a cardinal releases and refusing to release that statement in full. Sometimes things are taken out of context, or maybe only one out of every 10 statements is reported on by that media outlet. So it depends on where we're reading the sources to, where we find where the Catholic Church is able to operate on things like the ceasefire in 72.
Yeah. So this media picking up, is that local newspapers, or would that be UK-wide? Or
so there's a huge differentiation between this. Obviously, a lot of local newspapers will have their own sort of political agenda for each one when we think about that. But what I've argued a lot in the book is that I've really picked up on the British media, whether it was something more left-leaning or more conservative, reporting in a very interesting way on the conflict and the church's involvement with it throughout. And where it comes to fruition, and really a big aspect for the British media, was where the English Catholic Church comes in. The English Catholic bishops would frequently comment on the conflict in Northern Ireland. this doesn't seem like so radical to people that are not in the church, but what happens a lot with the church is that you're only supposed to really report on something in your own national boundary. So English bishops reporting on an Irish situation or something that the Irish Catholic bishop should be reporting on or should be talking about or commenting on is quite rare and very unusual. So that's why I pick up on it a lot in the book. So the British media, anytime the English bishops say something different about the conflict than the Irish bishops, is it reporting that and saying, look at the division within the church, look at what's happening here.
So is that a division within the Catholic Church in Ireland and the Catholic Church of Britain, or is that just how it's reported?
No, there's definitely a division within the English and Welsh Catholic Church and the Irish Catholic Church. The Scottish Catholic Church is a separate institution as well. The English and Welsh Catholic Church has a different viewpoint on a lot of things that happen throughout this conflict. The big things that I focus on the book is the issue of suicide, excommunication, and Republican funerals. The English bishops have a very different viewpoint on that than the Irish bishops do. The Irish bishops have an understanding of their own country's history, the way that Catholicism is practiced in Ireland, and it's very different to English Catholics. So we see quite a difference of opinion on what's going to happen. And this is also very much comes to the head with the 1981 hunger strikes too.
There are a few very influential Catholic church figures in this, but probably known more so than Tommaso Fee. Mm. Now, he covers a lot of ground right up until his death in 1990. Can you give us a bit of background on him and his role in this period?
Tommaso Fee is a really fascinating character, and I honestly think he's incredibly under-researched. We only have one very small published biography I found of him that was published right after his death, and I think that's really not great for our scholarship. He needs to be more well-researched. He was born in County Armagh from a very nationalist family. His younger brother also becomes an Irish priest. He starts life, as I start the book, as Tom Fee, and by the time he becomes a lecturer at Maynooth, at St. Patrick's College Maynooth in Irish history, he adopts the Irishized version of his name, Tomás Ofi, Tomás Ofiach, some might say as well. So he is very not afraid to be public with his Irish nationalist viewpoints. Once again, he condemned violence throughout the conflict, but he wanted a united Ireland and he wasn't afraid to talk about that. This belief and this want and this desire puts Ofi in very much a sort of combative position with a lot of unionists and a lot of other Protestant ministers at the time. So when he takes over as the Archbishop of Armagh after Cardinal William Conway dies in 1977, we see an interesting tenure for the leadership of the Irish Catholic Church. There's someone that's much more nationalist and entrenched in Irish history versus someone like Bishop Cathal Daly, who becomes the Bishop of Down and Connor in 1982, who's much more conservative. For the period of the 1980s, Cathal Daly and Cardinal Tommaso Fee sort of balance the church in a way, or trying to balance the church in a way, between someone that's much more openly nationalist with their viewpoint and someone that's much more conservative about the conflict. So Ofee gets himself into a lot of hot water throughout the conflict as well.
Of course, Ofee is the highest ranking Catholic Church member in Ireland. Mm. I would say that would open up him up more than sort of lower down in the hierarchy to comments and interactions from Rome. I know in the past, you know, when you've had like the likes of William Walsh, who was Archbishop of Dublin, Thomas Croke, who came into conflict with the Vatican over their nationalist leanings. Is there any sort of sense that he came into conflict with the church hierarchy above him?
So that's a really interesting question. It's something that I've been trying to find as much information about. The Vatican's archives for this period are also closed, as well as trying to get any of Ofi's papers. It's very difficult to get them as they're not available yet. What I have found is actually strangely from the UK National Archives. They've published a lot of papers because during the 1981 hunger strike, Margaret Thatcher met with Pope John Paul II, and it was commented on that sort of she was battling Ofi for this idea about what to do relating to the hunger strikes. They're both sort of battling for the Pope's attention over this issue. So it's very interesting to look at that material. It doesn't seem that he's in conflict too much with the Vatican, with the Holy See, but it does seem that he was chosen for his strong leadership skills. He was chosen because he sort of understood Irish history for that context, which is very interesting as well when we see that the Vatican will go on to choose Cathal Daly, his total opposite, for the next Archbishop of Armagh when Ofi suddenly dies in May 1990.
Yeah, Ofi popularly is known for his role in the hunger strike. In what way was his role defined in that particular period?
So Ophir is, like I said, a very interesting character. From some of the interviews I've done, you know, he's condemning violence, but when he goes to visit Lancash, he's slipping some of the Republican prisoners cigarettes as he's looking at the prison conditions during the prison protests. I mean, famously, he compared the prisons during the prison protests to the slums of Calcutta. That was a very famous speech that he gave and drew a lot of controversy for the British government, who very much condemned those words. Ophir had been trying to, alongside Bishop Edward Daly, to speak with Margaret Thatcher, to work with the Northern Ireland office, to work with Thatcher's office directly, to create some sort of compromise, to give some of the prisoners five demands to them. What could they be flexible on? I think from the archival papers that we're able to find, he was pretty frustrated in this fact. He thought maybe they could compromise on two or three of the five demands, but in the end, they weren't able to. So what happens, I think, is a lot of other priests that are working behind the scenes sort of step up in this. What I argue throughout the book is that you kind of need a carrot and stick approach. You need somebody maybe acting in a very public way, along with people privately being able to communicate between parties to get anything done or to have the Catholic Church make any impact.
Right. Okay, so you mentioned people who are behind the scenes. I don't know how behind the scenes these people were, but they had a different role in the hunger strikes. I'm thinking Father Fall, Father Oliver Crilly, and Brian McCreesh. Brian McCreesh was related to one of the hunger strikers, was it?
Yes. So this is really interesting. So Father Dennis Fall very much works with the families of the hunger strikers to convince them to medically intervene and to save the hunger strikers' lives. He's very much criticized by Republicans for this decision. It seemed to undermine their protest. And that's still that sort of feeling against him because of the hunger strikes is very long held. But he did work with those families. Father Brian McCreesh and also Father Oliver Crilly were both related to some of the hunger strikers. So it's very interesting to look at their roles in this. When I spoke with Father Oliver Crilly, he was telling me about trying to be there pastorally for them as prisoners, but then also being there as sort of a familial touch. We have to remember that a lot of these hunger strikers hadn't seen their families in a long time because they had been protesting prisoners. So Oliver Crilly gets to see those family members and see those relatives. Brian McCreesh is an interesting case as well, and I found out a lot of this through the UK National Archives when those files were released about this. What we found was that the British government was actually taping some of the conversations the McCreesh family had, especially with Father Brian McCreesh, and they were watching him. I mean, he was the one that was actively trying to petition Margaret Thatcher to save his brother's life. But I think it's very interesting to think about these familial roles these priests have, because sometimes we think, okay, they're priests, they have to be bound with these very certain or specific ideas about their own faith, they have to adhere to the church, but they're also human beings. They have family relationships, they have their own responses to the conflict built on their own experiences, and I think the hunger strikes really illustrates that for a lot of priests.
One of the byproducts coming out of the hunger strikes is the rise electorally of Sinn Féin. What reaction do the Catholic Church have to this sort of new direction of Sinn Féin?
That's a great question. The Catholic Church, the hierarchy doesn't quite know what to do with itself. I mean, before the rise of Sinn Féin, the Catholic bishops are able to say, well, the IRA, no one supports them electorally, they have no mandate to be doing what they're doing. And to a lot of people, well, it looks like the rise of Sinn Féin, who are very much openly promoting and supporting the IRA at this period, it looks like, okay, this is their electoral mandate for the IRA. So the Catholic Church has to sort of find a new way. It walks a tightrope throughout the conflict of not trying to isolate people in vulnerable communities by completely denouncing everything that they're doing, but at the same time condemning violence and condemning anyone who supports it. So here's where this dichotomy between Cathal Daly, the more conservative bishop, and Cardinal Tomás Ophir, the much more nationalist hierarchy member, comes into play. At one point in the early 1980s, when he's commenting on why people might vote Sinn Féin in a, I think it's an RTE radio interview, Cardinal Ophir says, well, they might have supported Sinn Féin or voted for Sinn Féin because of their community outreach policies. This becomes completely outrageous to a lot of people. Unionists denounce them in the papers. Even the Irish government comes out and says, how dare anybody ever say that somebody votes for Sinn Féin for their community policies. Even Sinn Féin comes out to say people are voting for us because they're voting as a mandate for the IRA. And what happens is that Bishop Cathal Daly has to sort of walk back O'Fee's words here. He sort of has to temper the issue. And when during the oral submission for the New Ireland Forum in 1984, when the Irish bishops gave an oral submission, he brings this up actually in the oral submission and says, obviously we're being very empathetic. People will support ideas and support political authorities for their own reason. We as the Catholic Church still condemn violence on all levels. So here's where we kind of see the push and pull that's happening within the Catholic Church. So the rise of Sinn Féin electorally is just one of those sticking issues that the Catholic Church has to struggle with and deal with.
Yeah. Is there any, on a personal level, any sort of button heads between O'Fee and Daly at this point?
So from the archives that I do have access to, I have to kind of go on speculation. I mean, they're very different people. Cathal Daly was petite, bird-like, quiet, very theologically and very much conservative in his viewpoint, where O'Fee is this larger-than-life character that's very gregarious, and everyone that I've spoken to says he kind of leaves you with this warm feeling and leaves you feeling really comforted and like you've had a nice time. So they're very much the fire and ice. What we can do is kind of speculate on how that relationship might work. Publicly, they're never condemning what one another says ever, but it would be very interesting to see when those church archives open up even more, is their relationship commented on more?
So you mentioned about not being able to access some archives and then some archives in Britain. How do you sort of balance that out? I know there's a lot of oral testimony in that. It's always a problem with trying to do oral history, especially around the Troubles, as we've witnessed in the last number of years. Was that problematic, getting interviews, getting people to talk about this?
I have to first start out by saying I'm very grateful to those individuals that did let me interview them, including the late Bishop Edward Daly. It's a very difficult subject for a lot of people to go and talk about again, to really reopen those old wounds. And so I was very grateful that they gave me any time. At the time, I was just a PhD student knocking on their door saying, will you please talk to me about this? There were a lot of unanswered emails, unreturned phone calls from a lot of people, and I understand why people wouldn't want to be interviewed at the same time. These are very painful memories for many. So I was able to interview, and I was very grateful to interview the handful of priests that I did for this project. And I think it added definitely a certain richness to it, that you were able to have that firsthand testimony from these individuals. And it's a contentious time and a contentious topic to discuss. When I first started doing the research of this book, actually, the Boston College had just really become to the forefront of sort of popular consciousness. So I think a lot of my interviewee subjects were quite nervous to talk, which I understand at the same time. But I think that material really enriches the book to be able to add that extra personal touch. I relied quite a bit on memoirs as well, as a number of the people that I discuss in this book are no longer with us. So I was able to kind of take what their memories were from those memoirs in a way. But oral history is a tricky bedfellow. You need to definitely remember what is happening. So that's why I'm cross-checking it with newspaper sources, with religious and government archival sources, to try and get the fullest picture possible.
So there seems to be a turning point with the Enniskillen bombing. It's a massive, and it's really impacted on this society for 30 years now. What effect did that have on the church's attitudes?
Well, I think this is the really interesting point, is that the Catholic Church had been condemning the IRA violence pretty consistently for many, many years at that point, really since the conflict began. So the Enniskillen bombing just really has the focus turned back onto the church by the media, by a lot of other groups that are saying, okay, condemn this, this is obviously horrific. And they do. They go out and they release, three bishops write a statement that's read at all the masses by that parish priest, condemning the violence, once again condemning the atrocity. But it's seen as, once again, not enough by the British media. The age-old question that keeps coming up again and again in my book is, why didn't the Catholic Church excommunicate IRA members? So many people are writing to both English bishops, Irish bishops, asking the question, why not excommunicate them? It's very interesting because the Irish Catholic Church never actually comes out publicly, really, with a response to this. Privately, in the documents I can see where a bishop replies to that sender, they will say, by doing these actions, the IRA excommunicate themselves, but they don't ever publicly say it. I think this is once again part of that balancing act. How do we not isolate vulnerable Catholic communities, but at the same time, we still have to publicly condemn violence? So Enniskillen is just another long line of examples where the Catholic Church condemns violence, but is seen as not doing enough.
Yeah. you've got a very changing Catholic Church over that time, and towards the end, your book goes right up till 1998. The 90s in the Catholic Church is really, you know, it's all about the scandals within the church. What impact does that have?
I think you see a lot of people with a loss of faith that begins in the very early days when the clerical abuse scandals start to come out. It's seen as, oh, this is just one bad apple. And then when we see that it's much more of a pervasive problem, not just through the Irish Catholic Church, but through the Catholic Church more globally, people start to shy away and move away from the church. We see a stark drop in weekly mass attendance, but also a lot of people not proclaiming their faith any longer. When it talks about the church in the peace process, it's not really, as an institutional church, able to operate that effectively in the peace process after 1994, especially with the Father Brennan Smith case when that comes out here. A lot of the times Republicans turned around and said, how dare you condemn us all these years when you've been letting priests abuse and molest children? And you lose that sort of moral credibility, moral high ground. So what does happen is we have a lot of priests that are working behind the scenes on the ground that are able to create these opportunities for peace. Very famously, Father Alec Reed and the Clonard Monastery, as well as Father Jerry Reynolds, create opportunities for dialogue between nationalists. But at the same time, you need priests more publicly, like Father Dennis Fall throughout that period, that was still condemning the IRA. Once again, this sort of carrot and stick. Somebody has to condemn the violence while other people are helping to mediate conversations in the background.
Yeah, and just to clarify things, the Catholic Church are doing mediation between Catholics and Protestants right throughout this, because in the very beginning, your first chapter, you talked about in Derry, the representatives from the four different churches got together at the start of, you know, the conflict. That continues right throughout, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There are so many priests, bishops, religious women that are creating opportunities for dialogue between Catholics and Protestants. So much of when I write a book like this, or when anyone writes a book like this, focuses on the people that are moving in really high levels. But there were so many opportunities for community relations, community engagement that priests and religious women were creating every day on the ground. Even if it's just to get people together for a coffee hour, they were helping create those opportunities. They were the ones trying to better how communities interacted with each other. Things like the Clonard Fitzroy Fellowship that happened as well here in Belfast were very important. Some people might criticize events like that and say Clonard Fitzroy, more middle class. Of course, middle class people can get together, but that's one sort of start that was able to happen throughout the conflict. And that couldn't have happened without groundwork from these priests and religious women.
That takes us up to 1998. That's over 20 years now. Where does it end off? Obviously with the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. How did that play out among people who were involved, you know, in terms of the church?
I think there was a huge relief, just like so many people felt here when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, of just a deep sigh and a deep breath that was kind of able to finally be let out. But something that I'm working on now, my next book is going to be on funerals during the conflict, is people, when they stopped moving after the Good Friday Agreement, finally had to experience and deal with that grief and pain they experienced from the conflict and reckon with it. It's sort of a PTSD that's happening not just with religious communities, but all over here. And that grief has been, I will argue, a big barrier to reconciliation. So what I'm trying to look at now is how priests and communities, how ministers and religious women are trying to mediate the funerals that were during the conflict, but then also really help people with their grief. It needs to not just be something that the churches are involved with, but an all society thing. Grief maybe should be considered a great equalizer, but here it becomes something that's quite hierarchical and something that's quite judgmental because people are still holding on to a lot of pain. So while the Good Friday Agreement is the ending for this book, the story, as we both know, continues.
Maggie, it is a really fascinating book and really interesting perspective on, you know, an era that is very familiar to people. Thanks for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.